dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A fascinating new front has been opened up with President Trump's decision yesterday to relieve James Comey of his duties as the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigations, a man who has been quite critical of Jim Comey for a long time and for, I think, abundant and very sound reasons, is our first guest. He is Joseph DeGeneva. These days, he is a founding partner of the law firm DeGeneva and Tensig, but he has an extraordinary record of public service as well, to his credit, including as the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia. He also, importantly, was an independent counsel at one point and has been incredibly influential with members of Congress and others, and always a welcome guest here. Joe, thank you so much for finding a few minutes in what I know is an extraordinarily busy day because of everybody wanting to know what you make of the Comey firing. Welcome back.
Thank you. Very nice to be with you, Frank.
So, well, to cut to the chase, what do you make of the firing of James Comey and especially, Joe, the response of people who seem to be very anxious to have him taken down a peg or two just a day or so ago?
Yeah, well, I think this was inevitable. I know that many people expected Mr. Comey to be fired on Inauguration Day, but the president was trying to be magnanimous after having taken the oath of office and decided to give Comey and the FBI a chance to restore their mutual credibility. It turned out that that was not possible, that Mr. Comey was incapable of restoring his own credibility or that of the FBI. I think it culminated last week in his testimony before the Senate, where not only was his testimony bizarre and factually incorrect, but he displayed a personality during that hearing which began to make people worry about whether or not he was stable enough to be the director of the FBI, given its power and the breadth of its authority to investigate Americans. That was the last straw. His personal description of the angst that he was suffering as a result of all the decisions he had made led people to believe that he had crossed an emotional line that had nothing to do with the public good and everything to do with Jim Comey's ego. And it was time for him to go in the interest of the public and the FBI.
So we're being told, Joe, that the justification was provided by the new deputy attorney general. It didn't get into a whole lot of details, but this is a guy who I think has been well respected. He has been supported in this recommendation, of course, by his boss, the attorney general. But what is your sense of the argument for taking this step now? I mean, obviously, part of it is this this question of credibility and stability, perhaps. But as it relates to this investigation, there's a lot of suggestions, particularly from Democrats at the moment, but some Republicans as well, that somehow this is creating a jeopardizing of this inquiry into whether the Russians interfered with our last election and to the extent they may have, did they do so in collusion with members of the Trump campaign? Give us your thoughts on all of that, if you would.
Yeah, well, I don't think that the investigation, such as it is, it's been relatively unproductive thus far, will be affected whatsoever. The FBI is on autopilot on things like this. They have a deputy director who has taken over as the acting director of the FBI, Mr. McCabe. These investigations will go on. A new FBI director will be named. My recommendation is Ray Kelly, the former police commissioner of New York, who is a stellar law enforcement official. But what happened here was there was no one in the department except Jeff Sessions. This was a decision that had to be made by somebody like Rod Rosenstein, who was just confirmed last week. He came in, he did a review of all the available evidence, he wrote a memo to the attorney general, and the president expressing his deep concerns for the conduct of Mr. Comey, beginning with the July 5th, 2016 news conference, one of the most bizarre news conferences in the history of federal law enforcement, and concluded that Mr. Comey could no longer serve as the FBI director because he had no credibility. That was the tipping point. And of course, the memo was written after Mr. Comey's testimony last week before the Senate, which was truly bizarre testimony.
Now, Joe, as I mentioned, you have in the past been a special counsel or investigative prosecutor. When you look at the claims that that's what's needed now, especially on the basis of the available evidence, what do you make of the advisability of doing that, and let alone the necessity of doing so?
Well, it's a straw man. I mean, the Democrats are arguing anything they can to go against Trump. This is part of the resistance against the president of the United States. The FBI is perfectly capable of investigating this with the career people in the Justice Department. I find it fascinating that the Democrats are asking for a special counsel when they were part of a group of all Republicans and Democrats who thought that the special counsel statute was something that should lapse and be left alone because it wasn't a very good idea and it led to improper use of authority by special counsels. I would give it to a special counsel just to shut them up. But guess what? No matter who you picked to be the special counsel, the Democrats would never be satisfied. This is an issue for them. It's got nothing to do with the facts or the existence or non-existence of underlying activity. There has been no evidence produced thus far by any investigation that there was any collusion by the Trump campaign or its associates with the Russian government. What's fascinating is you and I both know that all of this information that leaked out about General Flynn and others was something that the intelligence community people and the Obama people wanted on the public record. Does anybody really think if there were evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians that it wouldn't have been leaked by now? It's obvious that this investigation, in my opinion, professional opinion, is going nowhere because there is nowhere to go.
This is a critical point. Joe, as you look at the state of the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails and the real case that could be made of illegal activity on her part and on some of her aides, is that something that a new director should have the latitude to bring forward to the new leadership of the Justice Department for prosecution, notwithstanding the craziness that preceded all of that?
When Mr. Comey, at the July 5th, 2016 news conference, usurped the functions of the Attorney General, he misstated the law. He said that she didn't have the requisite intent. First of all, intent was not required for the statute under which she was being investigated, only gross negligence. But beyond that, there was intent. His tortured explanation about why there was no intent was simply wrong as a matter of law, and it was purposely wrong. He decided he was going to exonerate Hillary Clinton no matter what, and that he was going to be the savior of her candidacy. And by doing that, he besmirched all of the people who have prosecuted classified information cases on far less evidence than that existed for Mrs. Clinton and Uma Abedin and others. There is ample evidence that Mrs. Clinton violated federal criminal laws. It should at least be put in front of a grand jury, which it was not in this case. Mr. Comey was just happy to go along with the Obama administration's decision not to use subpoenas, not to issue search warrants, to grant reckless immunity to lawyers and other people. I mean, the stuff that he tolerated as an FBI director would have gotten other people fired. And so, yes, of course, if the department wishes to reopen that case, it has every right in the world to do so. It doesn't mean anybody would be charged, but at least it would be investigated correctly.
Properly, yeah. When and if such a review is conducted, would the amnesties that Comey gave to some of these witnesses or lawyers or what have you further complicate any such prosecution?
Oh, absolutely. They would complicate it greatly. They could preclude it, actually, and that might be part of the process that you would evaluate in the grand jury. I would put people in the grand jury. I would put in FBI agents. Why did you do this? I might even call Comey and call some Justice Department lawyers who are no longer there and ask, why did you do this? Do you have friendships with the people who are representing the Clintons and their staff in this matter? This was a very politicized investigation by the Obama Justice Department. It was a shameful exercise of prosecutorial discretion, and I would have no problem reopening, whether it went anywhere or not, just to make sure that it was properly investigated.
Amen. Joe DiGenova, thank you so much for your time today and for all of your service to our country. I know it will continue, hopefully, with us as well. We'll talk to you again soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Faith McDonnell is in the house, at least in a virtual sense. She is, of course, one of the country's preeminent authorities on a travesty that is playing out in our time, a really horrific civil war that has been unleashed on the people of the newest nation in the world, South Sudan. Faith is the Director of Religious Liberty Programs at a wonderful organization, the Institute for Religion and Democracy. She is also associated with the Church Alliance for a New Sudan. She's a frequent guest here and elsewhere talking about what's going on in that part of the world that we've often and for certainly far too long neglected. Faith, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us, and I'm looking forward to an update.
Thank you very much, Frank. It's good to be with you again.
So, very quickly, because this is a somewhat confusing situation, Faith, tell us about how we got to where we are at the moment. Remind us of the birth of South Sudan and what's happened in the short time since.
Okay. Well, yes. South Sudan was originally part of the country of Sudan, the Islamic Republic of Sudan, and for decades fought against the Arab Sudanese who were trying to Islamize the whole country and Arabize the culture, take away the African cultures. Finally, in 2005, thanks to President Bush and to help from the U.S., there was a comprehensive peace agreement that caused a ceasefire and eventually led to the splitting of the country in 2011 into what you rightly called the newest nation in the world, the Republic of South Sudan. Since that time, it's been very evident that the government of Sudan didn't ever want this to happen, and they have done things to be spoilers all along.
With devastating effects, needless to say, on the country of South Sudan. Our guest is Faith McDonnell of the Institute for Religion and Democracy. We're talking about a country she's deeply knowledgeable about, going through horrific civil strife and conflict. So finish this thought. What has been the agenda of Sudan, namely to undermine South Sudan, has played out in terms of a really horrific civil conflict. What exactly is the state of play at the moment with that?
Well, right now, there is famine in the land. There are devastating attacks going on. One of the biggest problems, though, is that rather than try to support a fledgling democracy that modeled itself after the United States, the U.S. was pushing for inclusion of the bad partners, the ones who had taken money and power from Sudan to come in and devastate the nation. And so we've got a situation where all the news that comes out says that these are two warring factions, when one is actually a sovereign government trying to maintain control, trying to maintain peace and stability over the country, but the world is looking at it as two warring factions of equal weight and equal importance.
Now, this was a legacy in part of the Obama administration, which was, if not actually, you know, sympathetic to the Islamists just about everywhere, at the very least was sort of taking a hands-off position on the government, as you say, that has been trying to maintain order and stave off a violent insurgency. When the administration changed hands, was there any difference in terms of the direction of the U.S. government towards this conflict and towards the understanding of where the legitimacy lies with one of these groups and not with the other?
That's a really good question, Frank, and I have not seen any evidence of that yet. I know it's early days, but right now, everyone, there has been so much false information and a false narrative that has been created on this that it's very hard to go against it. When you have the UN special experts from the Security Council saying the same thing. But let me just tell your people, for instance, the UN says that the government of South Sudan bans humanitarian groups from going to places where people are starving. I have the evidence. I have photographs of the thousands and thousands of approval forms that the government of South Sudan has given to groups to go in. If they don't actually give them approval, they say, go at your own risk. They don't ban people. And this is a lie that has been told over and over in the media about the government of South Sudan. And if they lie about that, imagine all the other things that they're lying about. And unfortunately, the new administration is looking at those same lies.
What should the Trump administration be doing in the present situation, as you see it, Faith McDonald? Is there a course correction that could make an appreciable difference in not just this bloodletting, but the future course of the South Sudanese government and their people?
Yes, I think that there is. I think that if the administration brought people in to help the government, to help them learn how to function in a new country better than they're doing now. These are people who went through such trauma. It's no wonder that, you know, they really have not found a way to go forward without help. But they have told us, me and my friends, they welcome the United States. They want to be the Israel of Africa. They want to be our ally. They know about jihad better than most people. They could help us with global jihad issues as well. So if the Trump administration took advantage of that and helped them to get control, a lot of the people who are being killed are not being killed by experts. They're being killed by cowardly ambushes on the road. And if there were strong men watching the roads helping them, that would stop. That would be one of the things that would stop.
Faith, you mentioned the jihadists. You mentioned their hard experience in South Sudan at the hands of these guys. That is, of course, something that the government of Sudan has been all about, Sharia supremacism and jihad. You have also documented over the years, I know, the predations of that government in Khartoum against not just the South Sudanese, but others that are still, alas, inside of that country, notably the Nuba Mountain people and the folks in Darfur. Give us an update, if you would, quickly on what's happening to them at the moment as well.
Yes, thank you, Frank. Still three genocides going on against the people of Nuba Mountains, Blue Nile State, and Darfur as the government of Sudan tries to totally, again, Islamize their culture. And a lot of these people are Muslims, but they don't want to be Islamized. And, you know, we're always looking for moderate Muslims to help us, people who don't agree with Sharia and everything. These are the perfect people if our government would enable them they are over 83% of the country, but they're called the marginalized people because the Arab center of Sudan has so marginalized and oppressed and persecuted them.
Yeah.
So
just killed them,
again,
among other things.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Faith, we have to leave it at that for this moment, but both of these are important points. Faith McDonald, I appreciate so much what you do at the Institute for Religion and Democracy. I know you'll come back to us again soon and keep up the good work in the meantime. Thanks so much for joining us. Diana West joins us next. We'll be talking about the Comey firing and much more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is a great pleasure to have with us, as we do each week at about this time, our friend Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist, a best-selling author of two absolutely superb books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, and an active contributor to the public policy debate, notably through her writings at dianawest.net and the Daily Caller and elsewhere. It is always a pleasure to have her, but especially on a day when we're talking about momentous developments like the termination of James Comey's tenure as the director of the FBI. Diana, so glad to have you back for that purpose, among others. Welcome.
Yes, wonderful to be back.
So, there is much thrashing going on in Washington at the moment, including from people who, as recently as, yesterday, I think, were seemingly very unhappy with Comey's performance, notably a whole bunch of Democrats. Now, the Democrats seem to be fit rot that he has been let go, and some Republicans seem to be joining forces with him. Give us your read on what's going on here, Diana, and should Comey, in your judgment, have been removed? And if so, for what? What reason?
What reasons? And I think we need a shout of hallelujah that he's gone. I mean, this was a I took that the firing with a great as a liberation from the directorship of Comey. It has been a travesty for so many reasons that, frankly, I don't know what collection of reasons we will ultimately come down to as being the final genesis of this move. It was long overdue. It should have, frankly, happened on January 20th.
Well, let's just dispense with the stated reason, at least in certain media circles, and that is that James Comey condemned unfairly Homa Abedin for having only sent a few emails to her disreputable now ex-husband from the Hillary Clinton account. That seems to me to be unlikely to be the best reason, or certainly the most compelling one. I personally think among them should be the really serious dereliction of duty with respect to understanding and helping FBI agents counter the Muslim Brotherhood and other Sharia supremacists in our midst. I know you're very concerned about that subject as well. Would this have been among the reasons that he should have been removed, and I would argue his senior subordinates as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. I don't know that figured into it. You know, frankly, it should have. It should have been the primary reason from the start. It was certainly one of the many primary reasons. I think when we look back on Comey and we try to understand this event in the last of recent months, it almost is Comey becomes a Rorschach test for everyone who looks at him, because he was such a political creature. There was such a sense of really untrustworthiness in terms of watching him twist and turn according to the political winds that seem to be blowing. So I think in many ways, the reasons for firing him are what your favorite reasons for firing him are in that sense.
A lot of grounds for doing so, in other words. But Diana West, the purpose that the Democrats seem to be coalescing around that was the justification for Donald Trump in their view, and that is trying to suppress or otherwise interfere with this investigation of alleged Russian interference in our election and collusion by the Trump campaign therewith. Give us your reading on where things stand with respect to those charges, and does this, in fact, in your view, constitute an improper interference in that investigation by the president?
Well, this becomes more evidence of Comey as this political football. He is what you want him to be. The day before he was fired by President Trump, he was the Democrats' whipping boy for Hillary Clinton's loss in the 2016 election. The moment he was fired, we had Senator Schumer out there telling the press that what President Trump was doing was effectively shutting down this investigation into Russian influence and calling for a special prosecutor. So again, this you again see how Comey becomes silly putty in everybody's hands in terms of what the political agenda they are advancing.
Not the role that we would hope for in an FBI director.
Yes, and I would just like to make a big pitch for a serious investigation, which can be launched from the FBI or by a special prosecutor, into Russian influence in the American political system at a minimum, so long as it is a bipartisan investigation. We're having bipartisan calls, if you consider John McCain bipartisan, for a special prosecutor into Russian influence. But the easiest way to open this up, and this is part of why it was so rich listening to Senator Schumer last night, we can go back for the perfect balance to investigation into the possible Russian influence on the Trump campaign and balance that with just a very recent example of documented Russian infiltration, intelligence infiltration into the New York Democratic Party machine of Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer. And I'm speaking, of course, about the 2010 illegal cell of about a dozen Russian intelligence officers who were living here as Americans under deep cover. And we already know from the FBI's counterintelligence investigation of this cell that we had a member of that cell who had become very close to the finance chairman of many Bill and Hillary Clinton campaigns, Alan Patricoff in New York. We also know that Hillary's own inner circle had been penetrated, reportedly by Anna Chapman, another one of these agents. There is a wealth of information about how this works and how it was working. And what's very interesting here is that the Democrats and Republicans both, I will add, shut this entire event down as quickly as possible. And Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State at the time, and that network was rushed out of the United States as quickly as possible.
Talk about cover-ups.
All normal procedures. Yes. So
before the FBI got their hands on these guys and properly interrogated them.
Absolutely. It would be perfect bipartisanship.
Dinah West, you've written about this powerfully at dinahwest.net, and I commend to you your treatment of the very important interview that our mutual friend Jenny Thomas had at the Daily Caller with my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, Mike Waller, on this issue and the need to make sure that there really is a comprehensive look by these committees or by the FBI or by special prosecutors or whomever into the bipartisan involvement with these Russian operations, alleged in the case of the Trump team and absolutely dead certain in the case of President Obama, Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, and others. Dinah, let me quickly switch gears. I'd like to get your read on what happened in France over the weekend with the election of Emmanuel Macron.
France elected itself into oblivion and destruction, and there is no more France going forward because they essentially endorsed the European Union project, which is anti-sovereignty, anti-nationhood, and they also elected to maintain the massive immigrant flow, which is effectively replacing the French population in many ways. There was a very powerful interview before the election at Breitbart with the head of a pro-Le Pen group called Generation Identitaire. And it was very, even though we know all these things, it was very shocking to hear a young political activist discuss the parts of France where there are no more French natives and conclude, it's finished, you know? Well, this was the French people, such as they are, electing to finish themselves. And that is my read on it, no matter how much happy talk we hear about trying to frame Macron as some kind of, quote, centrist, and Marine Le Pen as some kind of fascist. This was very simple. Put up a border or take it down.
We will be talking about this, I know, for months and months to come, I'm afraid, Dinah. But we look forward to doing so with you, that's for sure. Thank you so much for joining us today, and come back to us again next week. Next up, we will be speaking with Ricky Ellison about the latest developments in Korea and what they might mean for American missile defenses there and here. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's a great pleasure to have with us once again, Ricky Ellison. He is the chairman and founder of a very, very important organization. It is called the Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance. He's been in business for some time and has been relentlessly helping make the case for protecting the American people and our forces overseas and our allies against the evolving threat of missile attack. One element of which, of course, is now gaining a lot of attention, namely that emerging from North Korea. And Ricky has been spending time out in the Pacific of late, and I wanted to take stock with him about both the threat and what we can be doing about it. Ricky, always good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thanks, Frank.
So let's start with North Korea, Ricky. That threat is, as I say, metastasizing, I think is no other way to describe it. We have had in recent days a system known as the THAAD deployed in South Korea. Tell us a little bit about the threat as you see it and the importance of that THAAD system to helping mitigate it.
Well, North Korea has nuclear capability and short-range missile capability to directly threaten Korea, to directly threaten Japan, to directly threaten Guam, and it can hit Hawaii and the outer edges of our country and Alaska. That's today with capability. That's been tested and proven. The concern we have on not only on that is the evolving threat on the KONAs to the west of the United States. And then they showed the other bigger missile for all of the United States. So that is the actual threat that we're facing today.
In other words, there is a danger and a growing one. President Trump has been very clear about that. So where does THAAD fit into addressing it, especially the shorter range threats that are present dangers?
So the United States has a system called THAAD, which is the newest developed missile defense system in the world. That system is deployed and fully operational in Guam right now, protecting our citizens in that territory. That system is fully operational and deployed in Korea. For the first time in the history of Korea, Korea now has a system that can defend the entire population.
The problem, though, is that the newly elected government of South Korea has been making noises about sending that THAAD system packing. I'm afraid that probably Donald Trump's comments about getting the South Koreans to pay for the THAAD may have further intensified the opposition to it. Ricky Ellison of the Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance, as you see it, how critical is it to our forces over there, let alone to our allies, that it remain operational?
We have 50,000 troops there. That system is our system. It's manned by us. We paid for it. It has been committed. It'll be very challenging, even with the government, who's already said that they would respect that decision, to try and have the Americans take it out, because that thing is also there protecting our forces, and the threat there is real. So it would be extremely challenging for even that government to try and push that out.
Ricky Ellison, you were just telling us about the threat that some of these existing North Korean missiles could represent to Hawaii. You were out there testifying very recently, encouraging the government of that state and the government of the United States to get their acts together and deploy or operationalize missile defense capabilities that we have that might protect the people of that state. Tell us where that stands and what impediments, if any, are there to actually executing on that plan?
Well, 2 weeks ago, the Pacific Combatant Commander, Admiral Harry Harris, testified in Congress, both on the House and the Senate, requesting more interceptors, more sensors against the North Korean threat, who he felt would easily overwhelm the capability that we have today defending Hawaii from Alaska, and moved on that. So as I said today, they have liquid fuel capability that's been tested and proven, the Tapodun 2 and the Mushodun, not very accurate, but capability to strike as far as our outer reaches of the United States of America. You have Hawaii is basically lesser protected than any other territory or state in the United States of America today. On the other hand, they have capability on the island today that is exactly proven, tested, and developed. We paid for it, $450 million Aegis Ashore site that is now deployed in Romania, defending Europe from Iran. And they're going to put another one in there in Poland. And they're finishing off developing our newest missile that we cooperated with Japanese, the SM-3 Block 2, that has a lot more capability than the current missile. That missile, its earlier generation, was the one that was used to shoot down a toxic satellite in 2008, going faster than ICBM within a couple inches. It was hooked up to the X-band radar. So what I'm basically saying to you, we have the capability right there on the island. And within 24 to 48 hours, we can fully make that capable as an additional layer. And why would you not have an additional regional missile defense layer? We paid $4 billion for that for Europe. They've got one, and the threat is not as great.
So we've got the capabilities. We've got some of them already in place in Hawaii. We could very quickly, I gather, put additional defenses there. It sounds as though this should be a no-brainer, Ricky. What's the problem? Is there an actual opposition to doing this step?
I can't find that problem. I would assume it was the policy of the previous president that did not want to do this. I would assume it could possibly be that, hey, we told the Russians that the site over in that we put in Europe could not shoot down ICBMs. So those may be the barriers, but I don't think the president understands that issue as well as he should. And certainly what's very interesting is that the federal delegation, besides Representative Tulsi Gabbard, have not listened to the Admiral Harris, who's the expert of the whole thing.
So in other words, we need to get cracking on this. And I've got to believe that Donald Trump would want to do that if he were aware of the situation. So let's hope we can help him do that.
Here's reality. We have a launcher already in place that's already been certified, ready to go, that's already been fired upon. We have missiles that we can fly in there to fill that launcher within 24 hours. We've got crews that are operating out of Dahlgren, Virginia, getting trained for, we can fly those. I mean, it's that easy. And it's already hooked into the BMDS system.
This sounds like it ought to be a very urgent priority. Ricky Ellison, we appreciate the efforts you're making with the Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance to call attention to it, and we will do the same. Ricky, let me ask you about one other thing. We understand that the administration is going to be pursuing a new missile defense programmatic review. What is your assessment of what they'll do with that? Will it, in fact, as President Trump has signaled, make clear the need for a much more comprehensive and robust missile defense, including against Russian and Chinese missiles, especially the new threats of emerging hypersonic and maneuvering warheads? Or do you think it'll be more of the same? And if so, is that a function of who's going to be conducting that review?
You're absolutely right. This is a critical review. We've only had three of them. I think the first one was in 1999 We had one by President Obama when he first came in 2008 that really moved to have the EPA, the European Missile Defense. We have an opportunity to really break out of this, to be able to create a much more complex, much more global, much more persistent capability, cheaper capability against our near peers and not limit it to Korea and Iran. And that's where it should go. Secretary of Defense Mattis told on Friday that he has put in place the Deputy Secretary of Defense to oversee that report, and that report will be due by the end of the year. Obviously, there's been a lot of work on that report since, but they have had nobody overseeing it from the Trump administration. And that person's not even to be confirmed probably until June or July. And there's got to be influence from the policy.
Ricky, thanks so much. Great to talk with you as always. I appreciate the great work you're doing. I hope you'll come back and keep us up to date about it. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.